welcome to the My Breast, My Health podcast. My name is Tasha Gandhimihaja and I'm your host, and I'm also a breast cancer surgeon. In this podcast, I have conversations with experts in the field, as well as those who have been affected by breast cancer. This is the second season and I'm so happy to be back, and I thank you so much for joining me. If you are new to the podcast, then welcome. And if you have been a regular listener, then I welcome you back. In today's episode, I talk to Toral Shah. Now, Toral is a nutritionist and a chef with a master's in nutritional medicine. She is passionate about the role of food in health, especially in cancer prevention, as well as the role of functional medicine in the treatment of disease. You can really sense how she is so dedicated to conveying this message through her presence on social media. This episode was an absolute tour de force as we covered a huge array of topics, from how she became interested in the role of food in health to her story of her own cancer experience. We also talk about what functional medicine is all about, to health inequity and everything in between. You should also stick around to the end, as Toral also gives us some valuable, actionable advice that can help kickstart a healthier lifestyle. Now, this particular episode was recorded during the summer when lockdown was eased. And so times were slightly different when Toral and I had this chat. So without further ado, here is my conversation with Toral Shah. Hi, Toral. Thank you so much for coming into the podcast. How are you today?
I'm good. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. Thank you so much. How's your day been? It's been all right?
Yes, it's been busy. I think that it feels like London is quieting down, because it feels like a lot of people have left the city to go away, whether it's locally or abroad. It is peak holiday season. Obviously, people are staying in the UK with the whole COVID situation. But I can feel that there's, at least where I live, it feels like it's definitely quieter, which is actually quite nice. Because where I live, there's a lot of restaurants and bars and like fun stuff and markets. And it's been a little bit overly busy because it was open before everything else. And I think people were kind of traveling in to come here. And now obviously everything's open, it means there's fewer people here, which I prefer.
So I really wanted you to come onto the podcast, and thank you so much once again for agreeing to come on, because you're a really interesting person to get to know, and you've got a lot of good stuff to talk about. So first of all, I know that you are the founder of The Urban Kitchen, and your work focuses on the role of food and diet in health generally, but also cancer in specific terms. Just out of curiosity, had you always been interested in the science of nutrition, or did something kind of spark your interest in the subject?
It's definitely not something I was always interested in, because I think, you know, when you think back to just the way nutrition is, we didn't know much. I mean, people were not talking about this 25 years ago. I've definitely always been interested in food. And when I went to medical school, I didn't even think about the fact that we weren't learning much about nutrition. It didn't really occur to me. But what happened was my mum had breast cancer halfway through medical school. And I started to sort of think about how can I help her to recover. So she had a mastectomy, she had chemotherapy, she had radiotherapy. We're really, really lucky because my mum has four sisters and my dad's got a couple of sisters. And you know, people took turns to come and stay with us to help look after my mum. My brother was away at university, I was at university, and you know, we couldn't cope on our own. And I kept thinking, what will help her to regain her strength and her vitality after all of this surgery and treatment and throughout? So I started researching and looking for nutrition and lifestyle changes that we can make. And there's very little out there. There are definitely long-term epidemiological studies happening, but all the results were out, and those which aren't, they were quite vague. So I started looking into this. And every week I'd find something in the dusty kind of university library, because obviously everything was on paper then, it wasn't online. And I would go to my mum's oncologist with these papers, and he would be absolutely like, oh, what has she done? Why is she coming to me? And there was basically people that never talked about it. So my mum, we ate quite a healthy diet anyway. We would have, you know, mostly vegetarian, lots of vegetables and fresh fruit and things like that. But you know, I did sort of do a bit more research, and then a poor woman, she came up and had to eat so many things like wheatgrass and whole garlic cloves and black licorice, fresh licorice root and stuff like that. Poor woman, she ate it all. And honestly, I realized that, you know, why are we not learning more? And I felt quite out of love with medicine at that point. And I realized that, you know, we know that we're starting to understand that there's a lot of things that we could do ourselves in nutrition and lifestyle. And yet there was all these scientific studies happening, but none of this was being translated to doctors. None of this was being translated to patients. And you know, and it was a very new science. Fast forward, you know, a few years, and I had worked in research for a while. I actually left medicine and I worked in research for a while. And I suddenly thought, you know, this is the way to go, nutrition. And there was a master's program at the University of Surrey, which did nutritional medicine. And I thought, hang on a second, that's where I'm going to go. So that's really, like, right. I think between, I would say, my mom's breast cancer diagnosis and finishing university and working. So I would say between 1999 and 2004, that's when I really started to get into nutrition and understand a lot more. And this is, you know, well before it became a topic that people were talking about. You know, I was 15 years probably ahead of the game. And I then did this master's in nutritional medicine, which it was an amazing course, which is still an amazing course. And I know that Rupi of Doctor's Kitchen is currently doing the master's now. So it's one of the best programs, certainly for people who've already got a scientific and medical kind of knowledge base already. And wow, so that's really what happened. Yeah.
That's so awesome. That's such a lovely story that you embarked on this whole new thing because of your mum's diagnosis. And I think that's just an amazing thing to do for her.
And I think what's interesting is that a lot of people who go into nutrition have, I think there's two groups of people. There's a lot of people who've had eating disorders, particularly the younger nutritionists and issues who've gone into nutrition. And there's also a lot of people who've become nutritional therapists who, again, had some health concern, whether it's cancer or whatever. And those are people often gone into it late in age, who maybe haven't had a science background. And so I think I'm quite different to both of those groups of people because I have, you know, huge interest in health and stuff. I don't have any eating disorders. I like my food a lot. And I really came to this with a real evidence-based approach. It's like, what is the science? What's actually happening? I'm not saying that others aren't. They are, but like they've come from it with a different filter. And I've come from this whole personal approach, but also for very much a, okay, what's the latest science and what's actually happening? What can we do?
And what you have learned so far or around that time, did that help you change your lifestyle and your behavior in terms of how you approach food?
I think some of it did. I think I was becoming a lot more health conscious anyway, as far as my own health. I had a boyfriend at the time who was really into food. So we were eating at really lovely restaurants a lot of the time. And then we both realized that, you know, even though we're in our early 20s, that we needed to get fitter. So this is when I started to really get into the gym and training and all of those things. I think my family always ate healthily anyway. You know, we're not snackers, we're not fast food eaters. We definitely love good food and go to restaurants, but day to day our food is, you know, it's eating the rainbow, eating, you know, lots of colourful fruits and vegetables, whole grains, you know, nuts, seeds, you know, legumes. And that's partly because we had half the time an Indian diet and half the time we kind of had more of a Mediterranean diet. And yeah, we've definitely tweaked things, all of us, and definitely probably think about it a lot more now. But it's certainly, I think part of it also came from just being really passionate about good food. And I think, again, back in 99, we weren't really known in the UK necessarily for our cuisine. And that's something that, you know, has, I think we've got London's one of the most exciting cities to eat in. Yeah. So all of those things together combined have definitely made a difference to how I eat.
Obviously, your mum had breast cancer and she was treated and she's thankfully fine. And then, unfortunately, you were diagnosed with breast cancer at a relatively young age, weren't you?
Yeah. So I was actually just finishing off that master's that I was talking about in nutritional medicine. And I was 29 and I felt I was in amazing shape. I was training for triathlon. I found a lump and I watched it for a couple of weeks and didn't really go away. And then I showed my mom and she's like, let's just wait for one full, you know, cycle. So we did. And then eventually went to the doctors, but it just took a really long time to be diagnosed because everyone's like, oh, you're just 29. You're not, don't be silly, you've got breast cancer. And I think that's something that's not changed much in the last 14 years, that younger women still find it quite hard to get diagnosed with breast cancer or, you know, or any cancer. So eventually I was diagnosed and it was a huge shock. I didn't know that I would possibly have to deal with breast cancer in my lifetime because my mum's sister, my aunt, had breast cancer, and also about 10 of my mum's cousins have had breast cancer. So there's definitely a familial link in our family. We don't have any of the BRCA1 or 2 genes or any of the other kind of gene mutations like TP53 or PLB1. But we definitely have something.
And everyone hasn't been found yet, has it?
We haven't been found yet. And some, but we have all had ductal carcinoma, and all of us are very estrogen progesterone dependent. Everyone's had it in the right breast. Yeah, everyone's had it exactly the same. Everyone, you know, diagnosed at different points. But I didn't think at 29. I thought maybe my 50s, 60s, whatever. But like at that age, it was very a bit of a shock. And also, this is before. I think Facebook was just starting. I felt like I was the only person in the world of that age that had to go through it. I think obviously eventually I did meet other people, but it's something that your friends can't relate to at that point. Yeah. Because very few people had it at that age, let alone their or even their parents, by that point. So it was emotionally tough. I think having a mastectomy at that point was devastating for me. And I was really lucky because I had a really, really good surgeon. Although I'm sure you might be better. This was back in 2006. And he, really thought about not just how I look physically, but also my mental and emotional state and what I needed. And I think that was really helpful. But I was caught at a very early stage. A lot of my cancer was DCIS, a ductal carcinoma in situ, and a little bit of stage 1. So we ended up having a mastectomy and my lymph nodes all clear. Then having tamoxifen. Again, they were very much on the fence about the whole chemotherapy and radiotherapy. And if you look at all the computer programs that can help you work it out, I was very much on the borderline. So one of the conversations that we did have, and I was very much involved in my treatment plan, was let's reserve the chemotherapy and radiotherapy in case you need it again. Because once you've had one type of chemotherapy, it's unlikely you'd be a candidate to use it again for the same type of cancer. So it's been interesting. I have subsequently had a recurrence a couple of years ago. But again, stage 1, very early days, breast cancer in the kind of near the skin.
So did you have reconstruction first time round?
Yeah, so I had a skin-sparing mastectomy and I just had the implant.
Okay.
So I didn't have a full... what would you say? Would you say that's full reconstruction or is that sort of temporary? I don't know.
It would have been a full reconstruction. So you had an immediate implant-based reconstruction.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And I think at that point in my life, it was the right thing to do. I was 29. Obviously, you still have the possibility of having children and all the other things. I was really slim. I didn't have much body fat. It was definitely the right thing to do. This time round, I had a lumpectomy to remove this reoccurrence, which was the same type of cancer, but it was a little kind of 16 millimeter stage 1 cancer in the skin. And so we had a lumpectomy to remove it, and we're still thinking about what's next in some ways. But there's no chemotherapy or radiotherapy. Again, how much spread? So I guess the key for me is because my mum and my aunt had all had breast cancer, I was checking my breast from a very early age. And I think knowing my own body really, really well and what's right for me and what's not right for me and really knowing how my skin feels and my scars feel has helped both times. The second, the recurrence was only found because obviously you don't have a mammogram on the mastectomy card, and I had stopped having MRI screening, which has been over 10 years. And the only reason I found it is because my scar felt weird and I can't even explain why it felt weird. Right. It just felt weird, and I just insisted that they give me an MRI scan. And I guess that's maybe they. I know that they may have not said yes immediately to other people, but for me, they know that I've never in all those years I never go and say, oh, I'm worried. And I know it's easy when you've had breast cancer or any cancer to be really concerned and then feel a bit hypochondriac and then keep going. I've never done, and that's easy. That's partly because I've worked in the field, so I understand it, and I can understand why people do that. But for me, I've never done that. So when I insisted, they did it. But I also feel that a lot of people sadly do get dismissed because people say, no, it can't be, don't be silly, kind of thing. And I feel like this is a problem, particularly with the current situation with COVID, where obviously services have been decreased and people can't go as quickly to see their GP, let alone to the secondary kind of centre. Yeah. So I am concerned about that.
So you found a lump, or you just felt that your mastectomy scar wasn't quite right, and they found a lump along the scar or within the vicinity of the scar.
Yeah, within the vicinity of the scar. Yeah. And so I had that like sized, and now I have a whole new scar, which is just horrible. But
this is actually a really good point to raise, because when people have a mastectomy, it is not true to say that a recurrence will not happen, because a recurrence can still happen along a mastectomy scar. Because when we do a mastectomy, we can only remove up to 90% of the breast tissue. So between 5 to 10% of breast tissue is left behind. So It's so important for people to realize that if you have a mastectomy, whether it's a simple mastectomy, so you're flat, or if you have a mastectomy and a reconstruction, it's so important to get to know what the skin of that, where the mastectomy had been done or the new reconstructed breast feels like. Because like you said, you just felt that the scar wasn't quite right and you got that looked at. And it's something that, you know, people need to be aware of, I think.
I think also because my scar had been so consistent for so long, the fact that it did start to feel slightly different.
Yeah.
If it'd been maybe within a year or two, I would have probably thought, oh, it's just settling. But because it'd been quite a long time that it felt exactly the same, that's what alerted me to there being something that wasn't quite right. And I couldn't really, and I have to be honest, I couldn't put my finger on it. It was just sort of like a sixth sense. And also this just feels weird.
Yeah. And I think it's also important to just trust that gut instinct. You know, sometimes you just feel, you know, that just, I don't know what it is, but I just feel that something isn't quite right. And if you have that feeling, I would just urge people just to get it checked out.
Absolutely.
Obviously, you know, devastating to have a diagnosis at the age of 29. And many people at that stage in their lives would be incredibly busy, like I'm sure you were, that, you know, people would be kind of embedding themselves in their careers, possibly looking for a relationship or planning to start a family or planning to get onto the property ladder. I mean, you know, 29 is such a young age. How did that impact you at that time in your life? And how did that diagnosis impact you?
No, you're absolutely right. It does impact you. And I'm not saying it doesn't impact older people, but I do feel that when my mom had breast cancer, she was certainly a lot more settled in many ways. Like my brother and I were both in our 20s. She'd been with my dad for, you know, X amount of years, like, the, you know, however many years, 25 years. I think, you know, they had their dream house, that, you know, they were very embedded, you know, like everything was sorted career-wise, you know, all of those things. I think when you're diagnosed young, and I say late 20s or early 30s, it impacts you in ways that you don't even think about when you're being diagnosed. So one of the things that happened to me was that I didn't realize it would impact my ability to get a mortgage, because I couldn't get life insurance within the 5 years of having breast cancer. So I couldn't get a mortgage on my own. I had to have a guarantor. Like, so luckily my parents were amazing and like helped me, but you know, that's not always possible for everybody. Things like, you know, meeting someone. Like, for me, it's certainly been something that's a bit harder, because it's always a conversation is when you've had a mastectomy and there's a visible scar. Yeah, especially if you have physical, you know, or sexual relationships, you do need to tell them at some point. But the point is, when do you have that conversation?
Yes.
Because I don't want people to necessarily touch me on that side either. I find it very, I'm very sensitive, especially with, like, you know, at the beginning it was painful. So it's, again, you have to have those kind of very honest conversations quite early on with people in some ways, which feels a little bit forced.
Yes.
I think, you know, career-wise, I felt like in that age group, firstly, I'm the youngest of my school friends. My birthday is in the summer, August. So I always felt like I'm playing catch-up with my school friends, which is ridiculous. Yeah. But, you know, and then it just meant, it felt like in that time frame when I was having all the surgeries, suddenly it felt like everybody met people and was getting married or buying a flat or, you know, moving forward their careers. And I just thought, oh, my God, I just felt held back for so long. And what's interesting about that is, even with the second recurrence, I felt the same thing. I've been held back, and it is really hard. I think this time around, I know a lot more people who've had cancer, and like, I think with the internet and social media, it's much easier to meet other people of your own age or same, you know, at least similar stage in life. But the first time around, you know, just even my friends were wonderful, but they didn't understand what it felt like. understandably. And so for me, I felt very alone, and it was really hard for them to support me because I didn't really know what I needed or what I wanted. But I was really lucky because I did find the Breast Cancer Haven, and they had a younger woman support group. And honestly, that group was such a savior to me.
Oh, brilliant.
There were other people who, you know, I don't know if there was maybe one person in their 20s, but yeah, at least the rest were in 30s, who understood kind of what I was going through. And actually, some of the girls I met there have become, you know, I'm still friends with. Sadly, some of them have passed on, but there's certainly a few of them that I'm still friends with. And actually, funny enough, one of the girls, she won't mind me saying, but we met there at this group. And I think it was maybe a little bit later on, after a few months, certainly, you know, and we'd become friends. And we'd kind of lost touch again. And then when I was back in hospital in the Marsden in 2018, I bumped into her, and she'd also had a reoccurrence. And it actually meant that, and we're roughly the same age, and actually it meant that we've completely reconnected, because we'd met, you know, and we'd stay friends for about a good 5-6 years. And we'd, you know, Facebook friends and stuff, but we hadn't really hung out properly. And like, having had her go through this again with me roughly the same time frame, even though we had different things like treatment plans, has made a huge difference. And you know, she just messaged me last night saying, when she can come out and she's not shielding, when can we meet? And I think having the support of other people who are in the same stage of life does make a difference. It really helped.
I'm assuming, you know, when you had your first diagnosis, social media wasn't around. So now, you know, in this kind of era, and having a breast cancer diagnosis or a cancer diagnosis of any form, really, do you think social media has, of course it has its negatives, but do you think it has brought positives to help people in similar situations and bring them closer together?
Absolutely, because it means that you can reach out to people who maybe don't live near you or go to the same centre or all of those sorts of things. I definitely think that it's easier to connect. I think other people going through, you know, to find people going through those experiences who are really, really in a similar stage to you, because, you know, you can find them globally. It's not just in the UK. I definitely think there's also a lot more information we share. On the converse side, there's a lot more information we share, and the problem is that everyone who's had cancer seems to have some sort of opinion or feels that they know best about nutrition, and there's a lot of people peddling a lot of very dangerous things on the internet. On social media about cancers and nutrition, and for me that's very scary. And people who are untrained, in fact there's someone I know who I did a campaign with recently, and it concerns me because she's not trained, you know. Yeah, she's doing this massive program, you know, talking about cancer nutrition, and it's really hard not to say anything.
You know, in some ways, people like you, who you're trained and you have an area of expertise which you're sharing to the wider community, is so important, because there's so much noise out there. And people need to hear voices that are reliable and accurate and informative. And so what you're doing is so, so important. And I think it's great that the messages that you're broadcasting out there.
Thank you so much. I want to do more. But again, if we're going to be really frank about this, again, the problem is there's still a lot of bias within health and wellness and, you know, medicine. And unfortunately, there's a lot of racial bias. So white nutritionists, white doctors, white people are more, at least algorithms on social media are more likely to promote them. And there's loads of data science to back this up.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yeah. So this is where it becomes a problem, because if you start searching for, you know, somebody, you keep following them. If you keep following a lot of people like that, it becomes an echo chamber, because you keep following people all saying the same thing. And now that, you know, I'm really conscious about diversifying my feed and having more melanoid voices on that, I think it's really interesting. And I'm actually being asked to speak at an integrative cancer conference next month. And I kind of brought up to the organizer, I said, oh, why are there very few people of color? Because there's some really brilliant doctors,
yes,
who are white British or whoever it is, you know. And I think that's problematic. Also, women are given a short shrift. You know, men are bound to be more likely to be promoted than women. And I think it's also this whole other thing of, oh, if you look good and you're skinny and you're a bikini and you're blonde, you're more likely to be promoted, whether you know anything or not. And again, that's problematic. So we have to look at the bigger picture. But sadly, there is inbuilt systemic racism, and this also means that a lot of people with a really good knowledge, I'm not saying, you know, white people don't have knowledge, I'm just saying that a lot of people with a really good knowledge, who are really knowledgeable, really studied, and they probably have less time on social media. Yeah, their message isn't being shared, whereas yes. people who know a little bit less but are really good at marketing themselves and can shout a little bit louder are. And that, for me, is problematic.
First of all, I didn't realise that there's an algorithm that favours, you know, certain gender and ethnicity. So that's quite mind-blowing, really. But so you are, you know, part of the BAME community. Would you say that your experience going through breast cancer treatment was different because you're from the BAME community?
I'm going to say no, not for me personally. I know a lot of people where it was. Partly being my mum is medical and set a really good role, you know, example of just talking about it. She, you know, and often in BAME or BIPOC communities, people, you know, Black, Indigenous, people of colour communities, people don't want to culturally talk about cancer or yes. that they've had cancer or the treatment. My mum always talks about it. So for me, firstly, that made it easier. Secondly, having that medical health scientific knowledge meant that I could ask those questions. And the third thing was I actually asked a second opinion and met quite a few different surgeons and teams. And I have a really, really good relationship with my team. So my surgeon, Mr. Gui, he's of Chinese origin, but like more importantly, like we have a very close relationship, which we've built over many years. But you know, he was very, very kind to me at the very beginning. It is really different being young. It is, yeah, and he did specialize in seeing younger women. And obviously now it's become a lot more common, which is incredibly sad. But in those days, it wasn't as common. And I think having someone that understood it was different. And my plastic surgeon, Mr. Searle, who's retired, again, like understood how I felt about it emotionally and what I wanted and how I wanted to look and feel afterwards. And so I was very concerned about functionality and like whether I could do certain things. So one of the options for me was a lattice and flap, an LD flap. But I was a bit like, I don't know if that will work for me because...
You're quite athletic, aren't you, and quite fit.
I'm very, like, you know, in those days I was doing a lot of rock climbing. I was, you know, at the gym a lot, you know, outside triathlons. Yeah, swim. You need full extension of your arm. And I was concerned about that. So I think there are different concerns. I'm not saying that old people don't have those concerns, but they do. But anyway, going back to the pain aspect, because of my knowledge and the team I had, I don't feel at all, you know, there was any difference. However, my mum helped run an Asian cancer support group, so I always used to go, and a lot of people had a lot of poor experiences. My friend, Simon Thompson, who sadly passed away 6 weeks ago now, she started up a BAME cancer support group because she found that she wasn't getting the same support and treatment. And there's so many people in that group that I help to now manage who haven't maybe had the best experiences. And we know from statistics that Black women and women of colour actually need to go to the GP about 2.1 times more to be referred to get a cancer diagnosis than white people. And for me, that's a problem. For me, that just shows that we're not getting the same care. We know that there are poor outcomes for any people of colour in all cancer situations. We know they're likely to be diagnosed later, because maybe they're not, their community doesn't know if they get it, they don't have the language, the GP doesn't listen, you know, all of these different things.
What do you think we can do to improve this situation? Because, you know, you're absolutely right. I think you hear the data, and this data that is coming out is just absolutely heartbreaking.
No, it is. What can we do? I think firstly, education and helping campaigns, charities and people and campaigns need to feature people of colour. They need to feature different ages of people. They need to feature different body shapes and sizes and things like that. So, example, I did a breast cancer campaign recently for a big brand, and I'm not going to name them because I'm still having conversations with them. And I was probably one of the biggest people in that group. I'm like a size 12. Okay, I've put on a bit of COVID, you know, weight. But, like, you know, and I'm normally, I say, maybe 8 to 10. So, you know, that is a problem because we know that most women who have breast cancer are bigger. So why are the campaigns featuring very slim women? I was the darkest person there until I kind of brought it up. Right. Saying, why is there no one else of colour here? Why are there no Black people? Why are there no East Asians? Why are there no Chinese people? And that, like, you know, and they haven't noticed. So until we have campaigns featuring different races, certainly that making that information available and talking about it, we have to break the cultural taboos, because there is a lot of cultural taboo in lots of cultures, where people don't talk about their health, they don't talk about experiences. And I think with younger generations that is breaking, but still, like, I remember, I mean, this is a really bizarre and classic example. So I am very vocal about my breast cancer, and I have been, because my mum's always been vocal. But in that first, when I was first diagnosed, I had a wide local excision, a lumpectomy, and I was having that, and I was being wheeled down to the theatre, and the anaesthetist was walking alongside, as they do, and she was having a chat, and it turns out that she was this Indian lady who knew my mum. So we had a chat, and she's like, oh, I don't think you should really talk about the cancer, because, you know, you will want to get married, and you know, we probably want people to know. And I just thought, no, I will tell everyone, because A, they'll see, and B, like, I don't want someone that thinks that that's a problem. I'm not interested in seeing someone like that, you know, or family in that, like that. And I just thought, you're an educated woman, you're an anaesthetist, and you're perpetuating this taboos.
Very surprising, isn't it? I mean, you wouldn't expect somebody in that position to be telling you these things.
I also said to her, she goes, oh, I don't know, I won't tell anyone. I said, secondly, Hippocratic oath, you can't. Like, I was just really shocked. But, you know, the point is, it has to be a multifaceted approach. Like, for example, our public health guidelines are very much based around white men. So BMI, which is a classic example, which is in the news all the time in this war against obesity, and I'm saying this in inverted commas with the government at the moment, they're focusing on fitness, but they're not talking about all the socioeconomic things, like the food deserts, educating people how to cook, making sure healthy food is cheaper. You know, okay, for example, I'll give you an example. Right now, they've got this Eat Out to Help Out campaign, which Rishi Sunak has created. Great. But they've included places like KFC, McDonald's, Nando's, all of these fast food chains in this campaign. Yet they're telling us to lose weight. So that doesn't make sense. It's not consistent. And also, why are we giving this money to big American corporations and not focusing on smaller British companies where providing seasonal, fresh, healthy food? It doesn't have to be always like super healthy, but, like, you know, the hospitality industry needs support. The smaller brands need help more than the bigger brands. So that's one example. I think they're not tackling the socioeconomic aspects. They're not tackling the fact that, you know, if you just look at hospitals, the food in hospitals is terrible.
Terrible.
There's a lot of vending machines, there's a lot of fast food rubbish, there's not healthy food for the staff, let alone the patients. Yeah, I've never eaten a hospital meal. I just take my own food. And so back in 2006, that was considered really weird. And I would come, my mum or my aunt or my dad or someone would turn up for every meal with a freshly made something. Because I was absolutely like, I'm not eating that garbage, you know. And how can you heal if you're not getting enough fruit and vegetables, you're not getting enough protein, you're not getting enough of the nutrients to physically help with post-surgery, you know, or post-chemotherapy? So for me, that's, you know, where there's so much work to be done.
There's so much work to be done. You know, we need to get back to the basics, right? Like, you go to hospital because you're sick and unwell and you need the best nutritional input as possible. And yet the food that is served is absolutely horrendous. And you think, well, I'm not getting anything nutritious out of this meal at all. How on earth am I supposed to recover and heal and get better and leave this hospital as quickly as I can?
Exactly. So,
it's, I mean, it just doesn't make sense.
Part of the problem is the government gives contracts out and they bundle together the food, the cleaning, all of this sort of stuff together. And then some sort of big company gets a contract for it. But how can you be doing cleaning well and food well and whatever else you need to be doing well? You can't be good at everything.
You're kind of involved heavily in, you know, an area called functional medicine, aren't you? And I think this is an area that I would say is relatively new, because definitely when I was in medical school, this didn't exist. So tell me. and it's been a while. But can you tell me a bit about what functional medicine is all about? Because I think this, you know, feeds into what we've just talked about, really.
Yeah, so functional medicine is looking at the body as a whole. And I don't want to use the word holistic. I think people you think holistic means just complementary and alternative medicine. It's not. But looking at the body as a whole and not just separate systems, and looking at the root cause of what is going on. So, for example, something that was in the news this week, that people who have chronic pain and there's no reason behind that pain, they shouldn't really be using as many painkillers like aspirin and paracetamol, it could be providing more harm. And traditionally, if there's been undiagnosed pain for whatever reason, that you would have been prescribed by your GP some sort of painkiller. And now we know that that's not probably the right thing. So it's really digging deeper and looking at what is underneath that root cause. So I think for part of it is that when we were at medical school, you and me, there was, and even now actually, they people only get 5 hours of lectures really, roughly on average, in nutrition. And this is global. This isn't just, you know, the UK. It's the same in the US. And this is all about lifestyle exercise. And obviously some people go off and specialise in their BSc, intercalary BSc year, or, you know, postgraduate, you know, kind of qualifications in sports medicine, exercise medicine, or, you know, whatever. But the fact is that most doctors don't know anything. And we know that lifestyle is a huge proponent of so many diseases. So if you think about cancer, we know that at least one third of cancers could be preventable through nutrition and diet and lifestyle changes.
Yeah,
that's a vast proportion. When you look at diabetes, it's even much, much bigger than that. You know, especially type 2 diabetes, it's essentially a lifestyle disease. So functional medicine tries to look a little bit deeper. It does go deeper than lifestyle medicine in the way that it's starting to make use of technology and testing. So looking at genetic and nutrigenomic testing, which looks at the effect of your nutrition and lifestyle on your genes. It looks at really measuring levels of different vitamins, minerals, and all sorts of other hormones at a level that maybe our NHS can't do. We've also got to remember that our NHS is amazing, but we only have certain funding. So we can't do everything. And also, if people haven't been educated, they don't know those options are available and to look at the link between nutrition and some of these levels. So for me, I think it's a really exciting new field. And I think it's the beginning of personalized medicine. And I think, you know, personalizing medicine is going to make a huge difference to how we treat people, particularly with cancer, because we know that, okay, there's certain gene things that, you know, make a difference, whether it's your BRCA1 or 2, but then there's many other different smaller gene changes. So, for example, there's something called single nucleotide polymorphisms. Those are single, tiny little changes in your genes for certain enzymes. And just by changing one thing, one of the kind of DNA bases, you can change how this enzyme might work, and this can affect your whole body. So actually, I had some testing done earlier, and I'm going to bring this up because I was, you know, kind of really interested. And like, for example, when we have estrogen, we need to remove the estrogen once it's finished, it's been used.
Right.
So I'm going to simply really oversimplify this. And there's basically, this happens with our liver, and there's phase 1, 2, and 3 of detoxification, and eventually it's water. You know, we need to make it water soluble, and then we either need to wee it out or poo it out, and that binds the bile. But if we've got issues with any of the enzymes that work in that kind of process, we could end up with more estrogen building up in our body. And one of the things we're starting to understand is that A, we have so much more estrogen dominance in this, you know, 21st century than we've ever had before, and that affects men and women. The second thing, this buildup of estrogen potentially could increase our risk to things like breast cancer. And I think that that's really interesting because we don't, as a standard, look at that in allopathic traditional medicine, but it's something in functional medicine that you may start looking. And yeah, it is something that is done privately at the moment. But I'm really hopeful that we will use all these studies and all the science in the future to inbuild this into our whole health system.
That's really exciting because so far, I think how we approach medicine is you've got a problem with your bones, you go to a specialist. You have a problem with your heart, you go to a specialist. You've got a problem with your skin, you go to a specialist. But actually, if that person is, you know, looked at in that person's entirety, I guess is what functional medicine is about. Then, you know, you can look at certain things as a whole system rather than systems in silos and say, well, actually, perhaps if you do this, then this can have a knock-on effect on this, which can help with this. And that's my take of functional medicine. Is that correct?
100%. So, you know, I'm seeing someone at the moment who has issues with anxiety and a few other things. But what I've realized from taking their full history and a load of other things, they probably are breathing way more through their mouth than their nose. And that impacts, right. That is impacting so many different systems in their body. But A, they're almost, you know, they're high anxiety levels because they're not getting enough oxygen and, you know, all sorts of other things. But there's so many links to their gut microbiome, there's so many links to, you know, like their stress levels, all of these things. And I think it is really interesting because, you know, I know I've had ENT issues in the past and growing up, and that's meant that I had probably more antibiotics as a child. And I'm sure that that problem had to be readdressed as I grew older and ate more, you know, different types of food and vegetables and built up my kind of gut microbiome. But it would have, you know, damaged my gut microbiome, which we know is the kind of root of many diseases. And we know that from a mental health perspective, that the gut-brain axis is really important. We know that if your gut and your microbiome is working, because the beneficial bacteria in your gut are responsible for so many of the activities that happen in our body. We don't have enzymes in it, but all these beneficial bacteria do. So even things like making vitamin K, we can't do that on our own. We need these bacteria. So I think there's such a link between all of us as a body. And I think if you think about Hippocrates, he really, you know, back in those days, kind of understood that, and we sort of lost that somewhere along the way. And I think partly because also we can't all know everything either. So we do need specialists. I don't think it's a thing of not. I think from the first point of call, if we had people who certainly could start off with look at your body holistically, starting with the lifestyle medicine and then the functional medicine, and I think we'd save a lot of money in the long run doing things that actually work for you. Yeah. Because we know that, for example, certain drugs are going to work better on some people than others from the genes. So things like that. I think it's really interesting. I think it's an exciting field. But I also think that in the long term, A, we'll be able to help more people. And hopefully cancer will become a disease that is always curable and hopefully preventable. And B, you know, it will save a lot of money for the health system by actually only focusing and targeting the treatments that really will work for you in person with your genetic makeup and your lifestyle and your environment and all those different things.
I think the future will be definitely personalized medicine, especially, you know, with more technology being around and more advances made in gene research. So definitely in the next, you know, 5-10 years, medicine will be definitely more personalized for sure. Do you think functional medicine has an impact on how we can look at breast cancer recurrence and, you know, living beyond breast cancer?
Absolutely. When I did my original master's in nutritional medicine, my thesis was about the effect of diet and, you know, lifestyle on the reoccurrence of breast cancer. And, you know, that was a lot more basic because that was quite a few years ago. But having delved a bit deeper, this whole thing with kind of understanding the link with stress, we know that stress plays a massive role in this estrogen dominance. We know that stress can affect our gut as well. It can also, like, if we have excess estrogen and we have to remove it, that can reduce our capacity for dealing with stress. It can also increase chronic inflammation and autoimmune disease and all that kind of thing too. And I think that's something that we probably haven't looked at before. Like, how often do people go for breast cancer diagnosis and they've talked about stress? And also, like, this whole diet, our kind of standard westernized diet is full of unhealthy fats, too much sugar, refined carbohydrate, caffeine. And so we don't have enough protein. We don't have enough healthy fats, enough plant-based foods. And the Mediterranean diet is amazing for that. But we know that that kind of diet and then things like skipping breakfast, just having loads of coffee all day, you know, that constant snacking, we know that's the perfect kind of storm for having this whole estrogen dominance. And that can imbalance our gut microbiome. And we know that having anti-inflammatory diet can promote gut health, but yet our standard diets aren't that. And I think, you know, there's still this whole misnomer that, you know, when you have cancer, you're going to lose loads of weight and you need to just eat whatever calories. But actually, if you look at most people, particularly breast cancer, most people are overweight and they're not underweight. And so if they can't eat for a bit, yeah, it's problematic in a way that they're not getting enough nutrients to keep their energy up and to heal and all those things. But we don't need to be worried about excess this kind of cachexia and, you know, weight loss that you used to see previously. And also anti-nausea treatment, all of that stuff with chemotherapy and stuff is so much better. So I think that's another interesting one. The other thing that I'm absolutely, like, super interested with from a personal perspective and professionally, but when I first had breast cancer, I was much younger, and I will take that. You do bounce back a little bit quicker if you're healthier. But I exercised the whole time. I had access to all my surgery. I was back in the gym like 2.5 weeks after mastectomy, which I don't really recommend.
Wow. But, yeah, that's amazing. What, 2.5 weeks?
I made my mum drive me and I could get a spin class and my arm strapped up and everything strapped up. I'm wearing about 2 sports bras and I'd cry every single class, but it just made me feel better. But I think that exercise, and we know from, you know, studies, and we know from all the work that's happening in Australia, that exercise can have a huge impact on your health in so many ways. A, it can help you recover and manage chemotherapy and radiotherapy so much better and tolerate it and have less side effects. But we also know that exercise helps with this estrogen clearance in so many ways. It helps the body's metabolism and storage of fat. It helps, you know, balance blood sugar levels. You know, we know that it can help lower the risk of breast cancer or breast cancer reoccurrence, and let alone, you know, weight loss and depression and all those things. So when people are told, oh, you should just rest and be careful, again, like, I'm sort of thinking, well, the science has been around for a good 10, 15 years. Why are we still giving this advice to people to rest up and not do things like that? And I think for me, it doesn't have to be you like doing a triathlon, like I was a crazy person, but I do think getting out and doing different types of exercise is really helpful. And I think having people to help manage and help that with that return to exercise, or at least to help create programs. I was really lucky. I had an exercise physiologist who's a friend help me back into exercise. So I know that I'm prone to overdoing it. And so rather than do that, I saw him for about 3 months where we slowly facilitated my return to what I was doing previously. I did quite a lot of weightlifting because that's so important for our brain health and our metabolic health. So I needed support with that. I think we also all need to do cardiovascular exercise to help our heart rate and then mobility, flexibility, you know, things for our bones. So all of these things. And I think we're not, again, like most GPs, most oncologists don't give this kind of advice. I think Professor Robert Thomas is amazing because he's in Cambridge and he does talk a lot about exercise and all his patients exercise. But most people don't. And I think we need to look at diet, exercise, A, to support people through and beyond treatment, B, to prevent recurrence, and also then obviously prevent cancer in the first place. So yeah. I think there's something for all of us to really look at. And actually, the interesting thing about lifestyle medicine, functional medicine, all of these things is that that's the first place to start. Exercise and not just diet, sleep. Sleep is so important. I know that I've put on weight in this COVID period because my sleep has been so poor. When your sleep is poor, the next day when you're tired, your hunger hormones increase. So you're more likely to eat, but also more likely to crave sugar and fat. So then And then also for me, I know I help manage my weight in some ways with exercise, my mental health with exercise. And I found it really hard doing everything in the same room because I have that big open plan kitchen, living room, office, you know, whatever. And so, you know, for me, like, it's been a great, I am literally back in the gym as soon as it opened. But, you know, obviously that's not right for a lot of people because of the COVID risk and stuff like that. But like having something that you can do, whether it's a walk with a partner, you know, a walking partner, whether it's a cycle ride, whether it's, you know, your commute to work, whether it's, you know, swimming, whatever it might be, doing some weights at home. But we all need to really think about this whole exercise perspective, for, you know, helping to prevent all diseases.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. Sleep is so important and it's underrated. And I think people perhaps don't realize how important sleep is.
Absolutely.
It has so many repercussions if you're sleep deprived. So sleep, exercise, and nutrition. Those are the things that you're right. I don't think we advise it enough to people. I remember I had a patient who was going through chemotherapy and she would do a Zumba class. I think the fourth day after her chemotherapy, and you know, it's amazing. And she really felt good after that, and it really helped her through her treatment. And exercise is something that, as you said, has been shown to help people recover better, you know, obviously live a healthier life. And it's something that we need to advocate more.
And then there's two other things. Another one is stress relief. Like, we really underestimate how stressed we all are. We're so stressed. And I think one of the interesting things that's happened with this lockdown and people slowing down is, like, obviously there's some elements of stress which have increased because people are just at home all the time and there's multiple at home and money and all those things. But in other ways, this slowing down and having time to cook and eat proper meals and all of that thing is going to have an impact on stress. And we are a chronically stressed society. And this is why things like breast cancer are massively increasing. And we know that there is a link between, and we don't know fully why, but there is a link between, certainly between stress and our estrogen cycle and our, yeah, and if you think about anecdotally and you speak to women and even men, but I'm sure you have personally heard, so many people have had a really stressful time or something traumatic has happened a year or 2 years, you know, before the diagnosis. And that means that our body's overwhelmed. So that's one element. And then the other point is the environmental aspect. Like, you know, we are in contact with more chemicals and estrogens than ever before. Our world is full of these estrogen mimicking chemicals. So, you know, like plastics and nail polish and perfumes and even things like surfactants in condoms and new carpets and, you know, gases from copiers and printers. You know, we're surrounded by this, let alone the pesticides and fungicides and whatever in our food, let alone all that stuff. So again, like, it's about thinking about all of this together. So for me, like, I think there's intersectionality, and this is like kind of really where we bring it all together. We need to look at our environment, but also that also feeds into how you know, the equality and equity with all people as well, like women, people of color, all of that stuff, and it all kind of intersects and fits in together. So we have to think about all of those things too. So when it comes to a breast cancer diagnosis, I think some people just continue as they are, some people delve really deep, and then there's other people that maybe there are things they could do, but it really, you need to think about your life as a whole and what you want and your lifestyle. And I think that's sometimes really challenging, and maybe we don't give enough support for people to really make those changes, and that's why they all turn to the internet rather than professionals who really use evidence-based knowledge, because they are people anxious. People want to make changes. They don't want to do all this stuff again. But then the problem is that there's too many loud voices who are from untrained people, which brings us back to the beginning, really.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, it can be quite overwhelming, right? So, you know, for the layperson, and you kind of think, okay, yes, I know all about this. I know I have to sleep better. I know I have to eat better. I know I have to do exercise. I know I'm a bit stressed and I need to reduce my stress levels. But they don't know where to start, right? They're going to think, this is just too overwhelming. I just can't be doing with this. I'm just going to go back to my normal ways and just forget about it. So on a simpler level, what simple advice would you be able to give people out there who perhaps is going through breast cancer treatment or has come through the other side, that, you know, a simple change can make, you know, a big impact?
Yeah, my first thing is eat the rainbow. Really think about eating 7 to 9 portions of fruit and vegetables a day. But when you think about eating the rainbow, it's eating all those different colors and having 2 or 3 things at each meal. See, that's not overwhelming. And if you just go for those colors, it's quite visual, it's quite easy. You know, we want, the more colorful our plates are, the more interesting our food probably is going to be. And use things like herbs and spices, because all of those things are so nutrient-packed and we forget about them. We think about the kind of macronutrients, the protein, fat and carbohydrates, but actually it's all these micronutrients that we really need from all these colourful vegetables and these herbs and spices. So that's kind of me, like, so obviously that's going to impact not just your health in the fact that you're getting more nutrients, but it's also going to impact your gut health. Also, when you focus on adding things in rather than taking things out, it's a lot more positive mentally. There's an easier change. I think it's easier to add things in than it is to stop doing things or remove things, which is why when you think about any sort of habit change, you do need to replace it immediately with some other habit. And eating that, you know, and that we know that gut health and cancer, there's definitely some sort of really interesting link. And I think that it's something simple that hopefully everyone can take on, and also something we can teach children to start from early age. And you know what, I'm a big fan of a chart with stickers. Rewarding yourself. So doing this with your family and having, you know, different members of family to see how many, like, or ticks or whatever you need to do on your chart of each day, eating those vegetables. And the more vegetables and fruits and things like that you eat, the less space there is for those unhealthy, like saturated fat, sugary foods. And that will help to change your palate. So these days, compared to our grandparents or maybe even great grandparents, we have a lot more sweeter palate, and they had a much more sour palate. And because there's a lot of added sugar and foods now. So by even like trying to eat some of those bitter vegetables, particularly those with breast cancer, those brassicas like broccoli and cauliflower, dark leafy greens, all of those things are super important. And also things like getting a vegetable box. So you don't maybe know what you're necessarily getting, but like it has that seasonal variety. So you don't have to even think about it. So the thing is, the supermarket, everything's available. Yeah, so you don't even know what's seasonal. And we know from studies that eat in season, it means that those vegetables are much more nutrient dense. So just hopefully that's a really simple change that people can make.
Yeah.
And the other thing is sleep. 90 minutes screen-free before bed. Like, that blue light really upsets and disrupts our sleep hormone, melatonin. And so get some blue light blocking glasses, get blackout blinds, make sure the room's cool, you know, and really no screens. So the people who try to fall asleep looking at their phone or the TV, or they watch TV and something really scary 2 hours, you know, for the last 2 hours, and then they suddenly try to get sleep, it's going to be disruptive. Way more people, more of us have sleep issues than we think. So whether it's getting to sleep or whether it's staying asleep, or even a lot of people who don't even realize they're waking up multiple times each hour, each night, and they don't even know. And by using some sort of tracking device, sometimes you can learn those. And those are just two things that, you know, anyone can do without any support, really.
Honestly, that's really, so that really good advice. And I remember when I first learned about Eat the Rainbow as a term, I think that's genius, because it's so simple. Just eat the rainbow and get as many colors as you can on your plate. And actually, that tip on getting a vegetable box, I think that's a really good idea, and something that I haven't actually thought about, because you go to the supermarket and you kind of get the same stuff that you normally get, don't you? You kind of buy out of habit. But if you get a box, you don't know what you're going to get, and you'd obviously try to use all that you get in that box. And seasonal eating is very beneficial as well. So thank you very much for that advice. That's really helpful.
You're so welcome.
Honestly, Toral, it's been such an amazing conversation. Thank you so much for all the expert advice that you've given. I have one question that you might be able to help me with. Having been diagnosed at the age of 29 and now having had a recurrence, what advice could you give your 29-year-old self that time might find helpful and encouraging?
Firstly, you'll be okay. It's not the end of the world. Gosh, that's such a brilliant question. What can I give my 29-year-old advice? I would, I think, talk about trusting myself, but really trusting myself.
Right.
And trusting I know what is right for my body. And that it will be okay. And I will, you know, that I will survive, and it's not going to be the end of the world. And I think it's really hard, because there's so many things I would tell my 29-year-old self. Things like, just like, slow down, smell the flowers, don't worry so much about like, what's going to happen to you. But I think my primary thing is, no, I'm going to retract that, actually. I was a consummate people pleaser. And right. I think when you become a people pleaser, and I think that it's been interesting, I've been having therapy since I was re-diagnosed with my recurrence. It's been so helpful. As a consummate people pleaser, I was always trying to please other people, and then I would be angry and resentful when they weren't doing the same thing back for me, and that caused me a lot of stress, whether right. it's physical stress, you know, emotional stress. And I would just say, stop trying to please everyone, try and please yourself, because life is just a lot simpler and it's a lot healthier, a lot easier. And I think it's something I've had to unpack 40 years worth of trying to be a people pleaser. And I'm absolutely certain that's been. And there's a really interesting book, and I can't remember the name of it, but I will send it to you, that has a really interesting section on breast cancer and showing that the personality types of people that have breast cancer, often women who haven't maybe been able to have that outlet to be strict, to kind of just do what they want to do in themselves. Now, I'll send it to you, because it's actually really interesting.
Oh, that's interesting.
It's written by a doctor, and when I first read it, I just thought, no, that's so weird. And now, obviously, I've become a little bit more holistic in my thinking. And I definitely think that when you are in a stress, you know, flight or fight situation, which is what happens when you become stressed, you know, your body can't distinguish between a tiger chasing you or you just being stressed because, oh, this and that happened. And that, we know that's inflammatory in our body. We know that that's increasing your cortisol, and that can impact your estrogen levels and all those things. So I really give that advice to myself, you know, just stop doing that.
That's really helpful. So stop trying to people please, and just give yourself, you know, kind of self-love, and give yourself permission not to do that.
Exactly.
Fabulous. Well, that's really good advice. I'm sure the 29-year-old Toral would have appreciated that advice.
I hope so. I'm probably not listening and done it anyway, but like, that's fine.
So for people who would like to connect with you and find out more about you, where should they go?
So I have a website, www.theurbankitchen.co.uk. It's having a little bit of work done at the moment, but it's there. I am quite prevalent on Instagram. which is at The Urban Kitchen. I have a Facebook page, Urban Kitchen London. I'm on Twitter, but I'm not very active on it. So you can find me in all those places. And I do quite a lot of public speaking and events. I'm ambassador for lots of charities. So you will see me, if you're in the breast cancer world, you will see me around speaking and talking and things like that.
I hope people connect with you, and you've got so much amazing information to spread out. And yeah, definitely, guys, check out Toral's website, because that's a really good place to start. Toral, thank you so much once again for coming on to the podcast. Really, really appreciate all the amazing work that you're doing. And yeah, once things kind of settle down a little bit, it'll be great to catch up.
Oh, I'd love to meet in person. I'm very excited. But thank you so much for having me, allowing me to kind of really be wide ranging in what we talked about, because I know we went to many different areas. So actually what I will do is I will share some of the books and the resources I mentioned, and maybe you can add them to the show notes.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll definitely put them on the show notes. And so people who want to find them can definitely check them out. So thanks once again, Toral. Really appreciate it.
Take care. Thank you so much.
Wow, what a fantastic episode. Thank you so much to Toral once again for a fantastic conversation. And if you'd like to check out the resources that Toral mentioned, then please head over to the show notes at www.mybreastmyhealth.com/episode21. If you haven't done so yet, then please hit that subscribe button so that all new episodes will be downloaded straight to your podcasting app of choice. New episodes come out every 2 weeks. So once again, thank you so much for listening. Stay safe and see you in the next one. Take care. Bye.